Hmm? Oh, it's there. You can hear it. Yeah, I was like, I don't know if I can. I may want to just go over, like here someplace.
Well, if there's any consolation, I don't think you're here and where to hear the vice president tell his work. Is that a small
You went to that? You went to that?
I did. Okay. Virtually no one was there.
Wow, that's astounding.
It was really sad because here they had paid all this money. Even the people at the conference didn't show up.
Oh my God.
So, and he's the vice president of Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I know. It's like, wow, that's astounding. The speaker isn't there, so I'm gonna...
Teach speech communication at North Central College out in Naperville in the suburbs. I just want to say a few words to set up this panel, and then we'll get right to our panelists, and I will introduce them. The news media's coverage of America's inner cities and of the nation's most pressing urban issues has arguably never been worse than it is today. Major newspapers like Chicago's own Chicago Tribune or the Sun-Times mostly cater their content, and actually fairly openly cater their content to a mostly suburban, largely affluent, and mostly white audience. Even the so-called alternative media in the city of Chicago, and I'm talking here about like the Chicago Reader, tends to cater their content to more or less affluent, middle-class youth living in the city, gentrifying neighborhoods like Logan Square and Humboldt Park. And really, with the exception of journals like the Residence Journal or the Chicago Reporter, two local Chicago publications, the media largely ignore the concerns of the vast majority of city residents who are African American and Latino, poor and working class. And even more disturbing from my perspective is the fact that on those very few occasions when the media choose to cover and pay attention to realities in America's inner city and the lives of working class and poor people living in inner cities, their coverage tends to be sensationalist, it tends to demonize the subjects of their coverage, it tends to be obsessed with crime and violence and social pathology. And I think if you want just a perfect illustration of that tendency, all you have to do is recall how the mainstream media covered the impact of Hurricane Katrina on the poor working class people of New Orleans. If you just recall that you had papers like USA Today running headlines that said, and I'm quoting, "The looters, they're like cockroaches." And you had the New York Times proclaiming that that inner city New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, had become a lawless place of fear. To recall that coverage tends to be demonizing and stigmatizing and stereotyping. Well, we've gathered together a panel tonight that's going to explore and critique the mainstream media's coverage of urban issues, and that is going to, I hope, propose some ways that we all can challenge media institutions to do a better job of covering the inner city and the urban poor and working class. And I want to just introduce our panelists, and then we'll hear from them. Okay, so immediately to my right is Beauty Turner. She is assistant editor of Residence Journal, which is the only publication that is written by and for residents of Chicago Public Housing. She's a longtime, a longtime resident of the Robert Taylor Homes, since the Robert Taylor Homes are no more. And she's also been a columnist for the Hyde Park Herald and other community newspapers. To her right is Paul Street, who was for a long time a senior researcher at the Chicago Urban League. He is the author of the book Segregated Schools, Educational Apartheid in Post-Civil Rights America. And he's got a forthcoming book called Racial Oppression in the Global Metropolis, which I believe is about Chicago specifically. And then finally, we have Lakeisha Gray. She is a journalist and media consultant. She's the midday producer and newsletter editor at WVON AM. And she is, more importantly, I think, for this panel, the chair of media relations for the 2006 National Hip Hop Political Convention. We're first going to hear from Paul Street, then from Beauty Turner, and then finally from Lakeisha Gray, and then I'll say a few words at the end. So, Paul, take it away.
How's that? Can you hear me? Well, first thing I need to do is thank Steve for inviting me to talk. Thank you, Steve, and also Michelle. out there. And I want to thank all of you for taking time to come out and talk about issues that don't receive enough attention, which are extremely important to all of us, to our democracy, to our city, and to our society. About a year ago, no more than a year ago, I was teaching U.S. history out at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Most students are white, come from the suburbs, particularly the northwest suburbs, fair amount from Rockford. I just finished the part of the first half of U.S. history where I talked about the rise of slavery and the dynamic interaction of class and race and how they produced this peculiar institution that became so central in American history. I talked a lot about class and race. Big core theme in the textbook that was assigned in that class was the contested meaning of the word freedom. And who's got it, who doesn't have it, what does it really mean to have it, and how there are very different levels of freedom, freedom of action, freedom of movement, freedom of power, economic freedom for people in America by race and by their class. And boom, Katrina hit. And I got this brilliant idea, which is typical of me, that I would really interrelate current events with past events, and I just tried to build a whole class around Katrina and talk about it as contemporary representation of the living historical legacy of class and race and inequalities and residential segregation and all kinds of very significant, powerful, important forms of oppression. And boy, was it a wake-up call for me. The six black kids, all of whom were from Chicago, three from the south side, three from the west side, got it completely. They understood what the people in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans were up against and how it wasn't just a tropical storm, but it was also a societal failure. The societal, structural aspect. White kids not only completely incapable of having any empathy for the people experiencing what they were seeing on television screens in New Orleans, not able to understand how a group of people could be trapped under difficult circumstances in an urban environment, seemed to be actively hostile towards the people who were being victimized in New Orleans and appeared to have a worldview which they could have blamed them for. As far as I could tell from some of the white kids in the play, they blamed these people for it. They brought it on themselves. What happened? I had run into a number of things in retrospect when I think about it. I run into the sheer physical wall of racial segregation in the Chicago metropolitan area, where people are so separated that the average African American lives in a census tract that is 75% black, and the average white lives in a census tract where just 1 in 20 people are African American. I could give you more statistics on that, but I won't because we don't have time. But the extreme physical segregation of people, which is still very much alive and well, right here in Chicago, 3/4 of the black population, just in Chicago, lives in just 22 of 77 neighborhoods that are 90% or more black. There's a very high level of apartheid, de facto apartheid today. This extreme physical segregation of white and black population from one another creates a segregation of experience that reinforces radically different pictures of the world, of history and of current events, and of how the world works. The fact of the matter is that because of segregation in large measure, typically black and typically white realities in terms of everyday experience in a job market, with transportation, with the police, the housing market, shopping, you name it, just aren't the same. And for a lot of whites in this incredibly segregated metropolis, black experience, black worldviews, black attitudes just make absolutely no sense at all. So I'd run into that. And I'd run into that many times before and wasn't surprised by it. I'd run into what I call a corporate neoliberal ideology that denies the role of any forms of societal or structural oppression at all in the creation of misery and poverty for anyone. We live in this sort of Oprah-fied New Age world in which everyone's world they're creating is of their own making. And there are no structural forces of any kind that matter, be they race or class or whatever. Run into that. I run into a conventional post-civil rights wisdom which denies the living relevance of an ongoing significance of societal racism as an issue. We all like to, a lot of white America has been led to think, well, that happened 30 years ago. Martin Luther King fixed that. Didn't they pass the Civil Rights Act? We'd run into that. I'd also run into the persistent white suburban moral panic over the black inner city that has been encouraged by corporate media here and across the country over the last 30 years. As my fellow panelist
Steve Masek notes in his really good book, which I highly recommend, called Urban Nightmares, one of the more striking aspects of American media culture during the last two decades of the 20th century was the degree to which it was permeated by images of the disproportionately black city as a zone of apocalyptic social decay, wanton violence, and depravity. Such representations, Steve says, encode the reigning conservative understanding of the urban crisis and give visceral, terrifying form to white suburban middle-class anxieties. They combine with television news that fixates on black underclass deviance and misbehavior to the exclusion of other, arguably more important stories about the city, and they do so in ways that tend to privilege victim-blaming voices of right-wing commentators and law and order politicians. Chicago media is no exception, and it isn't just about the news with its endless, relentless series of clips about black male suspects, right? You know, murder, rape, pillage, on and on, the constant drumbeat, you know, film at 10. I don't say film at 11 because they still live out in New York, but here in Chicago, you know, film clip at 10. And they paint the black inner city out as a terrifying zone of malevolent misconduct and profound danger. Nightmare zone, says Stephen, of crime and pathology, where out of control urban populations, crazed, looters, rapers, rioters are pretty much all to blame for their own misery. And I think that's a lot of what we saw with the Katrina coverage. I have a few things to say about Katrina, but I think I would put myself too much in a time squeeze if I went into it. You get a chance to go online. I did a piece, really getting the nuts and bolts of Katrina coverage. My name, Paul Street, plus framing Katrina. And I really, it was really fascinating the way that these sorts of fantasies, these white, middle, suburban, middle class anxieties were fed. During my time at the League, at the Chicago Urban League, right in the historical heart of the Black Ghetto at 45th and Michigan Avenue, between 2000 and 2005, I did my damn best I could to try and get regular routine empirical data and studies out about racial inequality and racial oppression in the city of Chicago. And I had two main obstacles. First one is the CEO of my organization, who recently retired, who may have been African American, but was thoroughly wrapped up in the white business community and white media. The CEO and the board, for whom, who were pretty much bought into the line, as far as I could tell, that these ghettos were just completely of them made and targeted back to people that lived in them, you know, and they had very little interest in questioning power in any particular kind of way. That was one of the other big barriers, was consistently dominant media, dominant local media. The press has refused, just flat out refusal to deal seriously with race issues and especially with racism. Because it's one thing to deal with race, and it's another thing to frame race in what I think is appropriately way in the context of racism and what it means today. And in this book I'm doing right now for Roman and Littlefield called White, there's a chapter, the second chapter is titled Whitewashing Global Chicago. Where, and in that chapter I give a bunch of examples of corporate media in Chicago, and I'm particularly the Tribune, but not exclusively the Tribune. I look at every dominant media outlet I can get a hold of, essentially deleting the race factor from coverage and commentary of current events in this great big apartheid city that we live in. And just to give you a few examples of what I'm talking about, sometimes it was just a matter of deleting race altogether. So, for example, in June 01, the Chicago Sun-Times had this big, spectacular front page story called Danger Zones. Like, well, danger, watch out, eye catcher there. It was all about, they broke down by the 77 community area, Chicago's 77 distinct neighborhoods, where the highest levels of accidental injury and accidental death were for kids. And they went and showed maps and all this kind of stuff. And I went and looked up at the census data in each community area, and they were all the most dangerous neighborhoods in the city were predominantly black neighborhoods. This is where most point where kids were just being accidentally maimed, you know, and killed and all this kind of business. And it was just off the chart. And of course, they couldn't say it once. They couldn't talk about it. They just left that out. They were uncomfortable with that, I guess. In March of 01, in February, March of 02, there's a bunch of stories in the Tribune about this hideous phenomenon of downstate prisons. In New York, they call them upstate. Here in Illinois, we call them downstate. All these downstate prisons that have become increasingly reliant on urban prisoners as their source of their economic development, right? All through downstate, all these prison towns, Vienna, Joliet, Ina, out on off on I-88, Dixon, all this kind of, is this new phenomena of rural towns putting their dreams in prisons, staffed by urban prisons. Couldn't say race once, even though in IDOC, the prison population is 2/3 African-American, 10% Hispanic. It's just a 15% black state. And 2/3 of those people come out of the Chicago metropolitan area. Just delete it. I got other examples of that in other presses. Just last year, in June 05, Rex Hupsky, who's actually a pretty good reporter on the Tribune, did a story about ex-cons, ex-offenders being released in Chicago. I guess they release 22,000 ex-prisoners to Chicago every year. And in the story, it says there's enough ex-prisoners being released to Chicago every year to fill up the United Center. This guy had talked to me when I was at the league. I had done a study called The Vicious Circle, where we broke down the zip codes of where the ex-prisoners came from and where all the ex-prisoners are going from. We just recycle all these prisons. We found that just 10 predominantly black zip codes in the city of Chicago were responsible for housing a quarter of all the prisoners in the state of Illinois. 10 zip codes in Chicago. That's 66 zip codes in Chicago. It's one of the most, mass incarceration is the most over-the-top racialized social phenomenon in this country. Totally going. In spring 05, there was a spate of coverage in the Tribune and the Sun-Times about Daley and his corruption scandals and evaluations of Daley as a mayor. It was really interesting. All these things came out. Daley had just been it voted the mayor of the country or something. Instead of the mayor, the U.S. Conference of Mayors had given him some sort of prize or something like that. And all these evaluations came out of the mayor. And I kept finding this one line again and again. It says, you know, Chicago is a great city. It's this, you know, growing city. It's this global metropolis. You know, it's moving forward to the 21st century. It's got one problem. One problem. It's this one downside. Andy Shaw on ABC said this. He said, every great city in the world's got a problem. He said in Rome, it says they whistle at women too much. You know, there's too much sexual harassment in Rome, and he had a couple of issues with other cities. In Chicago, it's corruption. You know, corruption. They didn't talk at all about the fact that there were 14 neighborhoods in Chicago where all of them predominantly black, where 25% of the kids were living at less than half the poverty level. Then nothing about that. Just exited. Nothing about 39% of the black kids in the city of Chicago living at or below the poverty level. Nothing about the incarceration rates, nothing about any of the endless list of unmet social needs in predominantly black neighborhoods. Nothing about the 16% of black Chicagoans living at less than deep poverty. Nothing about the extreme segregation. So nothing about race. Race is just over. It was very interesting. Chicago has one flaw, and that's corruption. This book came out, the Chicago Tribune published it along with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. They got a bunch of money from the MacArthur Foundation to do it. It's called Global Chicago. It's about what Chicago is nowadays. And we're a global city, and man, that's really great because we have Boeing, you know, what a lovely corporation that is. They make the B-2 stealth bomber and the Black Hawk helicopter and a bunch of other stuff like that. And there are more mentions in this book of Boeing. This is an estimation of where Chicago is at the turn of the 21st century. I counted it. There are more discussions of, in this evaluation of what Chicago is today of Boeing, which of course is all favorable. We're supposed to be really happy that we have the maker of the B-2 stealth bomber headquartered here. Now, they don't make this stuff there and provide jobs here. There's more mentions of Boeing than there is of black Chicago. It's just invisible. Just don't exist. There's maps in here of where the immigrant and Latino population is. They're real excited to see, they care about the Latino population in the city, which they should, but they care about that because that's an immigration population, and so that's a global population that feeds this whole notion of a global city. But these people that have been here since the late 19th century and early 20th century are just non-existent in here. This is Chicago Magazine. This is Chicago Magazine. This is the last April issue. It's a salary survey of the city of Chicago. Of course, we got Oprah up here. You know, Oprah, by the way, in surveys is the person that in the suburbs, the white people always say, see, everything's okay now because Oprah. And Colin and Connie and all that, but especially Oprah. In fact, sociologists even coined a phrase called the Oprah effect, which is the white denial that there's any race problem anymore because look, all these people are making. They got a map here of the city. I love this. It's all the community areas and all, and not the city, the whole metro area. Well, this whole thing is broken down, it's upside down, that's right, is broken down. They're into color, a whole bunch. They're all into color here. You got purple, you got green, you got blue, you got yellow. Yellow is poverty, purple is wealthy. Well, you got a bunch of purple people up here in Kenilworth, in Lake Forest. That's the big money. That's $150,000 a year. And I guess there's all these yellow people or something. That's a yellow zone down here called the South Side and the West Side of Chicago. They go on and on. So they're definitely in the color, but they can't talk about skin color, though. It's just invisible. To wrap up, and I got more examples of that kind of stuff. There's that deletion, the deleting race altogether, and then there's the deleting of racism. That's where you talk about things. Like with Katrina, you couldn't avoid that this was a racialized thing. But what was completely deleted was racism at all. And I noticed that the Tribune now has been citing this big study I did right before I left, right before I resigned, because I had to get out of there urgently because of the Walmart issue, because I kept pushing for the Walmart ordinance, and then my CEO was taking money from Walmart, so I had to get out of there. Did this great big study, all the facts you could ever want about race in the city. I really am wrapping up, about poverty. And the Tribune would not cover it. I mean, one of the premises of going to work in a mainstream organization is you do this stuff and we get covered, right? Because you're in the role of it. It was in the New York, it got a brief mention in the New York Times, we get covered in the Tribune. No mention at all. So I left, I resigned. The CEO resigned, got out of there finally. He's already retired on the job, but he finally made it official. I got someone new in there. I've seen the study mentioned 6 times in the Tribune in the last year, in the discussions about how Compton resigned. He's out of there now, he's somewhere. And by the way, Urban League did this study. Always the same statistic. The 14 of the 15 poorest neighborhoods in the city of Chicago are 90% more black. That's one of my statistics. That's actually one of the least horrific of my statistics. Yeah, worse than that. So 14 out of 15. I see it mentioned again and again. I've seen it mentioned in the Sun-Times. I keep seeing the statistic mentioned in mainstream media. And nothing about the whole analysis of the study, which was that was a product of racism and racialized social policy in Chicago. And that happens again and again, and you can't get through the embargo on that, except in very rare and unusual instances in my experience. And I've gone on too long, and we'll pass through the time. Thank you.
Okay, first of all, can everybody hear me? Okay. Well, okay. Okay, first of all, the name is Miss Beauty Turner. I'm the assistant editor of Residence Journal. Residence Journal is a bi-monthly publication that's written by public housing residents with national award-winning publication, okay? This is how I look. So when you see this on the street, grab it. Because actually tell the truth about what's really happening in the city of Chicago, okay? We distribute over 35,000 of those copies to schools, churches, and community centers, and even nail shops right near you, okay? But it's so important to have a paper like the Residence Journal for the simple fact, especially in these days and times. There's a CHA transformation plan, a $1.6 billion plan that this city have implemented on the poor. It first started off about the high rises. I lived in Robert Tullis for 16 years, and I raised 3 children, all academic achievers in college grades, right from the developments. The plan was supposed to be that they get rid of the high rises. But I noticed through the research that I've been doing, because I also do research, I work with a professor, a sociologist by the name of Sadir Venkatesh from Columbia University. And I follow the CHA residents and write about what's happening with them. There's many issues that the residents of public housing are dealing with. Right now, if you've been reading the newspapers, I write for 7 papers. If you've been reading the Hyde Park Herald, Lakefront Outlook, I'm a columnist there. And I've been writing about the issue of the Section 8 vouchers, okay? The city of Chicago gave out 35,000 Section 8 vouchers to low-income residents, but there's been many more Section 8 vouchers out there that's not even CHA or relocation related. CHA made a new plan. The new plan that they implemented was called Neighborhood Site Rule. This is also an article that I'm writing about. The neighborhood site rule states that you cannot rent an apartment with a Section 8 voucher, buy 3 or more vacant lots, boarded up housing, or suspicious criminal activity. Okay. We know Chicago, City Hall, there's nothing but suspicious criminal activity. The truck scandal, the water reclamation plant, the drug dealing that was there, the alleged federal contracts being given to families and members of friends, the patronizing hiring. If that's not suspicious criminal activity, what is? Okay? I was up at City Hall today. Matter of fact, I'll tell people that I'm a fighter and a writer. And I'm letting you know that because I am a fighter and a writer. I don't sit just behind a desk and write with a pen. I also defend. I go out there and I talk to the people that's necessary to be talked to. I went to City Hall today and I talked to Mayor Daley. Okay? I had 15 minutes with him. And he said, oh, Beauty, is this all off the record? But you know, I want to tell you something. When you're talking to a reporter, you're never off the record. Remember that, okay? I brought Mrs. Smith's attention about the CHA new rule, the new CHA rule about the neighborhood site rule. This is in my hand. Everybody see it? I have 202 pages, backwards and forwards, every ward with a city-owned vacant lots, okay? City-owned vacant lots. All of this is city-owned vacant lots. Backwards and forth, okay? I brought this to Mayor Daley. And I let him know. I said, how do you expect for people to live anywhere? Especially with a rule like this. He said, Beauty, I think it's a stupid rule. It's really a stupid, stupid rule. You know how he talk, right? Okay. But before I did that, I talked to him and I wrote this little speech just for him, and I want him to hear it, and I want you to hear it today. I say to you today, Mayor Richard M. Daley, when you look out your window and you see a homeless man hobbling in the Emerald Green Park and you pull the shade, you didn't stop that man from becoming homeless or from being homeless, but hit the dirt that you have helped create. Just like in the days of old when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. led a march in a rally in Montgomery, Alabama in 1965, and the politician at that time was George Wallace. He watched out his window through drawn blinds, but that didn't stop the protests and only intensified it more. We are saying to you today, Mayor Daley, stop sending your shameful dirt to the outskirts of Chicago, but face your wicked nakedness by looking at what the CHA Plan for Transformation will create. Devastation in maximum proportions. Unjust rules and regulations such as the CHA Administrative Neighborhood Site Rule that's been approved by HUD. A rule that states that people cannot live by vacant lots, boarded up housing, or suspicious criminal activity. I told them, first of all, my research revealed that most of the lots in the city are owned by the city. Plus, can anybody say City Hall? I asked them. If you can say City Hall, there's suspicious criminal activity there. I told him about the truck scandal, the water reclamation plant, the drug activity, the federal contract being given to his friends and family members, the patronizing hire. And then I say, need I say more? He giggled and said, Beauty, you know what? I'm working hard on that rule. I'm going to get rid of that rule. I really am. I said, okay. I'm going to keep you up on that. Either in my papers, or I'm be in your face. Either way it go, I'm gonna be on you. I said the CHA Plan for Transformation was only supposed to be concerning the high rises, but it has spilled over into the backyards of other low income housing where the poor is being pushed out, such as the low rises like Vanden Park, Ida B. Wells, the Rosenwald, Caesar Butler properties on the west side of Chicago, and now being set up in season for the chopping block. Our 540 units of HUD subsidized housing and low income called Grove Park Apartments, which is located on 61st to 63rd in Cottage Grove. This type of action from the CHA doesn't give the housing trust voucher holders a choice where to live. And to me, that's violating the 1968 Fair Housing Act. Anytime you're staring people out of the city of Chicago, there's a problem with that. Everybody in this room should have a problem with that. Because we do have constitutional rights. Last I looked, this still is America. This still is America, is it not? People, is this not America? Okay, but the main thing that I like writing about is what's happening with the residents of public housing. Not only residents of public housing, it is spilled over to developers calling me. Developers are calling me because they can't rent their property. They have built new housing right back, vacant lots, and they can't rent it. It is going into foreclosure. I have teachers calling me who lost their job after 29, 30 years. Not only do I have teachers calling me, I have young people calling me because they're going into different communities and they're ending up getting shot. Okay? There's so many issues that the CHA and the city of Chicago is dealing with that I'm beginning to call this Emerald City. And the reason I call it Emerald City because I do believe that the only thing Mayor Daley wants to see is the green and not the brown unless it's fertilized and green. Okay? But papers like Residents Journal need to continue to fight the good fight concerning what's happening with the poor, because they are being pushed not only out of the city of Chicago, but out of the world if we don't do anything about it. That's why it's important to have people like Paul and Steve and Lakeisha and people like you who are concerned about the issues to come out here so we can continue to do what's right. I mean, right and what's right, okay? And I always like to end my speeches with all power to the people. All power to the people.
Good evening. And my husband and children would certainly be a little put off if I didn't let you all know that there should be a Sewell and added to the end of their name. So it's Lakeisha Gray Sewell hyphenated name, married with children. And also I need to point out to you all that I left WBON in March of this year, so I'm no longer with WBON. I'm currently a media consultant and also, as Steve pointed out, the media chair for the National Hip Hop Political Convention, which was held here in Chicago in July. I'm green at this. This is the very first panel that I've sat on, and as you can see, the distinguished company that I have kind of makes me a little nervous, so bear with me. When I found out and I was asked to do this, I didn't hesitate to say yes, but I jumped into it before I really thought of the magnitude of it. And as I was thinking on it and praying on it, I thought, what am I going to say? And it's just ironic that we're here in a temple. And as I look to my left, I see the words, "We are more than conquerors in him that loved us." And that sums up the whole point of what we're here to discuss. And we are discussing poor people. Poor people are not black people, poor people are not Latino people, poor people are not those people who are in Darfur and Sudan, poor people are not the homeless people, poor people encompass us all. Every walk of life, every one of us is yet but a paycheck away. Even those who run companies like Boeing, they're going through their problems right now, and just one swipe of someone's pen higher up, and we can all face being poor. So let us just remember that. And I just wanted to talk about the poor. I reside in Englewood. I'm a homeowner in Englewood. I grew up in Bronzeville, yet but a few blocks away from Robert Taylor Homes. Those people who lived in Robert Taylor Homes were my neighbors, my family, friends, loved ones, everything. And so I never considered myself far removed, even though I know I came from a different such situation and station in life. I knew my mother kept it into my head and my family kept it into my head. We are all connected some way or another. And so I think that is what has driven me in my career into what I really want to do in my passions. Unfortunately, living in Englewood, I come to know of crime. I don't come to know of crime when I sit out on my front porch. I don't come to know of crime when my children are playing in my backyard, which they have done all summer long, in a swimming pool, just like any other child in the summertime hot months. You cool off in a swimming pool or you do anything of that nature for entertainment. My children have never ever had to duck under their beds because of gunshots. My children don't know what a gun looks like. My children don't know what a gun sounds like. But if I watch the news, Channel 5, Channel 2, Channel 7, Channel 9, I'm told that my neighborhood is dangerous and that my children are afraid to go to sleep at night in their own rooms. That's not so. I sit in my living room to watch my television. My couch and my sofa are placed in front of my window. I don't duck at night. I don't move into another room when 9 o'clock comes. So I don't know this reality that is painted by the mainstream media of our existence in Chicago, of poor people in Chicago. I don't know that existence. In fact, even when I lived three blocks away from Robert Taylor Home, I cannot tell you one time when my home was vandalized, where we were robbed, where anyone was beaten on my block. That didn't happen for us. And so I'm confused when I hear these rationalities of what it is to be black and poor in Chicago. I want to know where that place is, because I don't live there. And I think that what separates poor people, and let's go back to remembering that poor does not have a race. No race can claim being poor. You have people in Appalachian Mountains who are lily white, and they know poverty, more so than I've ever known. So we can't lay a claim to anybody being more oppressed or more poor than anyone else. But what I want you to know is that poor comes about in two ways. And the way that poor is described by the media, or to the media, or for the media, is by two things: access and relationship. I worked for 4 years for a black-owned radio station here in the city of Chicago. And I must tell you that there's division anywhere between the haves and the have-nots. The black haves and the black have-nots, the white haves and the rest of the have-nots, there's always a division. And so you have to understand that access and relationship is what gets your story across. And at times I wonder, is it by design that we hear these stories about the crime, or we hear the stories about what poor people are doing, if they don't want to work and they don't choose to work, and they are just into robbing people and killing, they don't actually want to work for a living. Well, first of all, let us all know that no matter who you are, what color, how much money you make or not, we are all concerned with the principal things, the quality of life. Everyone is concerned with shelter, quality shelter. Everyone is concerned with morality and living in a lawful society with order. Everyone is concerned with quality health. No one wants to be sick. No one wants to not be able to go to a qualified doctor and receive quality care. No one's wish is to live in an existence that doesn't support that. No one wants to live in this world without being loved or feeling loved. No one wants to not have someone who they can relate to, family. No one wants to not have access to an economy, a growing economy. When we think about the gas pump, just about everybody is affected by the price, the rising prices of the gas pump. Poor or not poor, walking, driving, whatever. You have to rely on some form of transportation, and so it does affect us all. No one wants to not be able to have access to things that give them entertainment, fun. No one wants to not be able to watch a movie or film while the rest of America and the rest of mainstream are able to take into a cinematic film. No one wants to be blocked out of that. And lastly, and I think what's most important, no one does not want to have access to books and knowledge. So these are all quality of life things I think that all of us would agree. And if there's anyone here who doesn't agree, I'll definitely take into consideration your points. But I don't think that there's anyone who agrees that that is just what people want out of life, no matter what corner of the earth they live in, no matter how much money they have or not. But let the media tell it. Poor people could care less about any of those things that I just named. And that is so untrue. And it is our responsibility to call the media on that and to let them know that there's another side, that every current event, even if it's the Foley deal that's going on now and what's going on with Congress, everything affects us all, and everybody has a perspective, and it is the right, and it is also the law for media to give that a voice, to give those diverse perspectives a voice, and they are not doing so. The FCC, for all the regulations that it has, for all of its incentives that they have, and all of the different things that they have going on, every time they're slapping some type of regulation or slapping somebody with a fine, they should slap themselves. And as poor people say it, or people in the hood say it, they should pimp slap themselves for what they're doing is a mockery for what the FCC allows to be called media and media justice. It's all wrong. And I could go on and on, but I really don't want to take up much of my time, but I'll just end it by saying this much. I've become involved with the National Hip Hop Political Convention and the Shylock organization of it, which is the Chicago Local Organizing Committee for the National Hip Hop Political Convention. Also with the Chicago Hip Hop Civic Engagement Project. And in hip hop or in music at all, music companies, they have this position there, which is called an A&R, Artist Repertoire, Artist in Development, so on and so forth. But in our organization, what we stand by and what we try to let everyone know is that an A&R stands for accountable and responsible. We are all accountable and responsible to one another. We are all accountable and responsible to making sure that the quality of life is that for everyone. That there is not a gap in between the have and the have-nots. And the biggest component in our society that reaches us all, while you're sitting in your Lake Forest living room and I'm sitting in my Eaglewood living room, or you're in your Bolingbrook living room and I'm in my Country Club Hills living room, there's one medium that can get to us all, and that's media. And as long as we realize that, then that is the one component that can bind us all, that is the one component that can save us all. And we all should speak up and let the media know that we all have voices and that all those voices should be heard. Thank you.
All right, well, I'm gonna try to keep this brief. I think that everybody on this panel is in fundamental agreement about what the problem with the media is. The problem is that the mainstream news organizations in this town, I'm talking about the network-affiliated television stations, the Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune, are not covering the kind of stories that Beauty was talking about. There's been virtually no follow-up coverage of what's happened to the residents of CHA public housing since they've been displaced by this plan for transformation, which, by the way, is actually an advertising slogan that was dreamed up by the Leo Burnett advertising agency as a way to sell this plan to demolish public housing and displace poor people from the city of Chicago. There's been very little follow-up reporting. And most of the reporting that's been done by the mainstream news organizations has been openly celebratory of, for example, the fact that poor people are being forced out of the Cabrini Green area and $500,000 condos and yuppies are moving in. So I think we're all in agreement about that. We're all in agreement that there's too much of an obsession with inner city crime and street violence in our news media's coverage of the urban core and inner city areas. I just want to mention a couple of studies. A big national media monitoring group, Rocky Mountain News Monitoring Group, Rocky Mountain Media Watch, for several years conducted a study where they looked at local television news around the country in big markets as well as small markets, and their study consistently found that on local television news, a third of the stories concerned crime and violence, mayhem, what they called in their study, mayhem. And print journalism is no better. Here in the city of Chicago, a group of media studies scholars up at Northwestern in 1993 did a story of all the news stories printed in the Chicago Tribune and the Sun-Times in 1993 about the community of Austin, which is relatively poor and of color. And what the study found is that 69% of the stories printed in those two newspapers about the neighborhood of Austin were framed in terms of social problems, especially crime. That the community of Austin was painted out to be an area that was just brimming over with crime. It's the coverage like this that was actually responsible in the 1990s for the anti-crime hysteria, which led to the passage of the draconian Clinton crime bill, which in turn helped to fund and helped to fill those prisons that Paul was talking about. People's fears of crime, becoming victims of crime, are totally out of proportion to the real risks that they face, even in inner city communities that do have relatively higher rates of crime than, say, suburban affluent communities. So my question is, why? Why is the media's coverage of the inner city so awful and so distorted? And what exactly can we do about it? And I just want to propose a few things. First of all, I think you have to look at the patterns of ownership of major news and media institutions in our community. Let's just take television. A group called Free Press recently released a report, and if somebody could come and pass out, if somebody could come and pass this around, I'd appreciate it. This is sort of the executive summary of this report. The report is called Out of the Picture, Minority and Female TV Station Ownership in the United States. And what the study found was that even though 33% of the population of the United States of America are people of color only own 3.26% of all television stations around the country. And in fact, the statistics for black ownership of television stations are even worse than for minority ownership of television stations as a whole. And in fact, the trend is getting worse. That is, there are fewer and fewer minority owners of television stations these days than ever before, thanks in large part to the FCC deregulating media ownership and throwing out provisions of regulations that used to ensure or used to grant preferential treatment to minority owners. And so as a result, there's very little minority ownership of television. Now, interestingly enough, here in the city of Chicago, there is one black-owned television station, but it mostly runs infomercials and religious programming. It's not affiliated with one of the big four broadcast networks, and that's true around the country, according to this study, that black-owned stations and minority-owned stations in general tend to be minor stations, tend not to be network affiliates. I have to think that that's got something to do with the horrible coverage that we've been getting in inner city areas. Secondly, I think you have to look at the management and staff of news organizations. Most of the journalists who work for the Chicago Tribune not only are white and middle class, they don't even live in the city, or many of them don't even live in the city. A study that was done by Peter Brown of the Orlando Sentinel found that journalists in major metropolitan areas around the country tend to be overrepresented in elite neighborhoods within the metropolitan regions where they live and underrepresented in the poorest neighborhoods. The same is actually true of editorial boards and boards of directors at television stations. If you look at the board of directors of the Chicago Tribune Company, you'll find that it's a who's who of corporate America, the people who sit on the boards of Fortune 500 companies, and so on. So that's part of it, too. It's the staffing and it's the management of these companies that I think partly explains why they give us such horrible coverage. And then I think another important factor that we often overlook is that most of the major media in our communities are commercial, for-profit, advertising-sponsored media. And the target audience for a lot of these ad-driven media vehicles is, of necessity, at least affluent, which means in our racially stratified society, they also tend to be white, and given the racially fragmented and economically fragmented nature of the metropolitan region, they also tend to be suburban. And in fact, in 1995, the Newspaper Association of America actually released a report urging all of the papers that belonged to the Newspaper Association of America to cut fringe circulation as a way of increasing advertising revenues. That is, they were encouraging newspapers to actively get rid of their low-income, working-class, inner-city subscribers so that they could sell their readership at a higher rate to advertisers. And as a result, the circulation directors of a lot of newspapers started doing things like taking newspaper boxes out of inner-city neighborhoods, started getting rid of discounts for inner city subscribers, and demanding that subscribers who were subscribing from inner city or poorer neighborhoods, demanding that they pay in advance rather than allowing them to subscribe on credit the way that they do for people living in the suburbs. In fact, in Los Angeles and Boston, the major metropolitan newspapers actually charge less for a per copy price for a newspaper in the suburbs than they do in the inner city, because they consider the suburban affluent readership that much more valuable than the readership of the inner cities. Well, that I think right there explains why we get such really god-awful coverage of inner city issues. So the big question is, well, if these are the causes, then what is to be done? What should we do? It's always the big question for me. It doesn't mean I'm a Leninist or anything, but I do think it's an important thing, an important consideration. First of all, I think it's important to have organizations like Chicago Media Action that are engaged in criticizing mainstream media for ignoring or distorting important stories about the inner city and the urban poor. We need to bombard newspapers and television stations with hostile letters every time they get the story wrong. Every time they print a story about the CHA plan for transformation that's basically just an advertisement for what the city wants to do. And we should take a page here from the right, because the right-wing message machine has been doing this for years. They have organized their activists to bombard television and radio stations and newspapers with letters every time a story comes out that they don't like. A group of us from Chicago Media Action a couple of years ago in St. Louis went into CBS, and we looked at the public file, and we looked at the kinds of letters that CBS were getting. And what we found was reams, thousands upon thousands of letters from right-wingers attacking Dan Rather of CBS for his liberal bias. And it was obviously part of a coordinated campaign. Now, the people on the left, those of us in this room, we don't do that. We don't engage as often as we should in this kind of organized campaigns of pressure and flack directed at mainstream media organizations. So that's one. Two, we need, I think, to protest to the FCC about ownership of, in particular, broadcast media, because the FCC has lots of power and authority over regulating ownership of television stations. And in fact, there is a group called Stop Big Media that is coordinating letter-writing campaigns to the FCC, encouraging people to speak out precisely about the lack of minority ownership over television stations. So if somebody wants to come up here and grab yet another piece of literature to circulate around, this is a sheet that has the website for Stop Big Media, and it's http://www.stopbigmedia.com/minority-media. And if you go to this site, you can send a message to the FCC saying that you are upset about the fact that 33% of the population in the United States are people of color, and yet only 3.26% of the television stations are owned by people of color. All right, I want to wrap up. Finally, I think it's just as important as, you know, trying to fight big media at the FCC and criticizing the mainstream media for the horrible coverage. I think it's important for all of us to support independent, non-commercial media that's created specifically for inner-city residents and is written by inner-city residents. And this is why I think Residence Journal is such an exemplary publication, and why I would encourage everyone to pick up a copy, to take out a subscription. I have a subscription, so I'm not asking you to do something I haven't done. Take out a subscription, and if you can, make a contribution to Residence Report. I think we also need to support publications like the Chicago Reporter, which reports on issues of race and poverty in the city, WEON Radio, KAN-TV, Cable Access Television, which is actually under attack right now in Congress, and programs like, for example, Labor Beat that deal with labor issues and deal a lot with immigration issues. So those are my three suggestions for actions, but what we'd like to do now is actually open up the floor for questions or comments, and maybe turn this from kind of a one-way panel discussion into more of a free-ranging discussion. And is that, Scott, is that microphone working?
Yeah.
Okay, nice. So if anyone's interested in making a comment or asking a question, please come up. And I'll pass this to whoever.
Good evening, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm Jonathan Briggs. I'm an urban affairs reporter at Chicago Tribune. I came here tonight as myself, as I often do. I go to community meetings really all over the city. What I'd like to add to your list of solutions is one, to form relationships with reporters at some of these mainstream newspapers and broadcast outlets who have a sense of mission about their work. I used to be a reporter at Chicago Reporter when Laura Washington was the editor and publisher, and I'm good friends with Alicia Tate, and I've worked with Brian Rogal, who works with you guys at Residence Journal, and I know the Tribune Foundation is considering support. I think they actually have supported Residence Journal, or are supporting Residence Journal. I could go on for a long time about what it's like to be a minority journalist in a mainstream environment, but I won't go into that whole discussion. But what I will say is that there are people of color and other journalists too that have a sense of mission about their work and who are concerned about issues of race and poverty, who try and actually sometimes actually succeed in getting coverage in the paper. And I know for myself, the 2 years that I've been here in Chicago working at the Tribune, and the 7 years I've been with this company working in LA and Baltimore, the stories that I do, people notice the kind of approach that I take. They always have an element of hope, they always have some kind of sense of solution to them, and they try to have a balanced, holistic view of what it is. I think a lot of the problems with the coverage is that there's a lack of balance. You know, you can't deny that there were two girls shot within 2 weeks in Englewood. The problem with the story is that you never hear about the other 364 days of the year when people didn't get shot. So, you know, and I put my attention on journalists of color because I know my colleagues tend to be more sensitive to the issue and be more advocates for the coverage. You spoke about management. Huge. This is, I won't even go into this. But my point is that if you don't have people who also have a sense of mission, who are in positions of power, as a reporter, I have influence. I don't have power. I cannot allocate resources to cover community. All I have is my notepad and my ideas and the relationship to have my editors to pitch and to try to advocate for stories. But ultimately, they decide. And if there are no people who are in positions of power who can advocate for the coverage and make it a priority, as much as creating revenues for Tribune is a priority, then it's not going to happen. So, I would just add that fourth caveat. Form relationships with those reporters. Reach out to them. When you see a story that seems to be spot on, or like, wow, this person is doing something right. Or maybe they're not doing something right. Invite them out to the community meeting. You know, try to keep them, you know, informed of other perspectives. And that's all I'll say, because I could go on forever about this issue. Thanks so much.
I just wanted to add to that, it is, again, going back to the whole issue of poor and color. And I can just tell you from my own personal experiences, when color doesn't even matter, because the person who is in that position has no relationship to poor. Even if they're black, white, yellow, brown, green, orange, whatever, aliens, if they have no relationship, no contact day to day on a daily basis with that demographic of people, then they don't know that voice. Those issues don't even register to them. Let's take, for instance, the supreme being of media, Oprah Winfrey. Clearly, she's a black woman. If we watch her show, most of the issues and the angles that she gives are not that of the common black person. And you have to wonder, Oprah is the executive producer, she's the owner of the production company. She has the final say. However, Oprah has on staff, at least, I know I just was watching it the other day, and she took over 100 people to Hawaii. So she has at least 100 people at her disposal. And when I looked at the sea of people and their families, not very many were black. And there were some who were. But the point being is that Oprah living in John Hancock Building, or Oprah living out on Malibu, or wherever she is, does not know the issues that affect those of us living in the inner city, or even suburban America. She's out of touch, is basically what I'm saying. So again, I don't think it so much is the color as it is the relationship and the access, if those people are engaged. So what he said about engaging people and having a relationship, it's key. And I think we ought to make sure that these people hold community meetings at their places of business. Make sure that they host the Chicago Media Action, host it at the Tribune, host it at WBON. Make sure that these meetings are held there on their own stomping ground so that they have no other choice but to listen. And the last thing is that the Tribune Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, a lot of these foundations, they have money to just give away. They give money away to hobbies for people. If you like picking green tomatoes, you write up a nice proposal about the green tomato picking that you'll do, and they'll fund you for that. So what you do is you get a group of people together who say, hey, we want a community radio station. We want to voice our own stories. And you get enough people together. You get people who know how to put a grant together. You get people who know how to produce stories, research stories. And it's not rocket science. It's really not. It's just you telling your day-to-day story. But at the end of the day, you write up this grant and you send it to these foundations and you get the money to do it yourself. Because again, A&R, accountable and responsible for our own destinies, our own stories.
I want to add one thing to that. I want to pick up on this notion that you can find some, you suggest completely, but you've got it off with some reporters of color. I saw some of that with my early position. Don Terry, who writes some pieces in the Tribune, are very good. Darnell Little wrote some very, and another reporter's name I'm forgetting, wrote some very statistically astute pieces. That's true. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. It sometimes color won't matter. If you still sort of accept the neoliberal, the corporate worldview, this is all sort of their fault. I saw a Clarence Page column recently that pretty much was down with Cosby. You know, he called Cosby's berating of the lower class inner city poor, you know, a plea for understanding, instead of what I read it as, a sort of vicious assault on. There's a few other cases of that. I remember when PBS ran a long series, had the unfortunate title America Beyond the Color Line, and it featured the esteemed African-American Harvard academician Skip Gates. Well, he's a person of color, but he is quite removed from the situation of people in places like Inglewood and Grand Boulevard, North Lawndale, and it amounted, and he ended up, you know, he was interviewed in the Tribune, there was a piece about him. I'm trying to issue a wake-up call, but his only wake-up call was the inner city people themselves. And don't get me wrong, there ought to be a wake-up call to everybody. But he issued no wake-up call whatsoever to discriminators and segregators and disinvestors and owners of currency exchanges and the prison industrial complex. I mean, personal responsibility, that's what I wrote a piece on ZNet about Bill Cosby is a two-way street. And there's all kinds of personal responsibility issues in Naperville, and Schaumburg and Lake Forest are problem area communities too. So yeah, I mean, you can find a good report and work with them. I always found that was a good thing. There's no substitute for having our own meaning too. And that's very important, because we can find that good reporter and he's going to move on somewhere else. There's going to be some new corporate merger. You know, the LA Times and Tribune said they need to get bigger, and they keep slashing these news departments. And those folks are gone. One of the problems institutionally, structurally, socially, sociologically with the Tribune is it is part of this downtown development machine, this growth machine that really does want these people out of these inner city areas. It wants to sell these papers, these rich people. And I remember when the Tribune, I remember Steve was talking about people were trying to sell papers, who they're trying to sell papers. Remember when the Tribune was beating up on the cab drivers? That was really, they were just going after cab drivers because they weren't making enough calls in underserved neighborhoods. Which, you know, cab drivers should make on call in underserved neighborhoods. They were just going off about these guys. And I thought to myself, someone ought to do a study, not only just where cab drivers do pick up, which is a real issue. But I worked at 45th in Michigan, you know, like you need a cab and it like takes an hour. It was hilarious, you know. Just want to do a study where all the Tribune boxes are. You probably find the Tribune was doing with cab drivers, was just following the money. And so this all comes back to some issues of separate, not equal, and segregation in the metropolitan area. And on that note,
well, first of all, I have to agree with Lakeisha and Paul, and also Steve. The reason that I agree is because every single day I run into the situation of someone of my color who don't understand anything about a resident from Robertella's, Cabrini Green, Stateway, the Rosenwald, okay? Every single day I'm talking to CHA officials. For some reason, they all think that it's God, okay? When you talk to them, like for instance, I talked to Terry Peterson before, and he's under the impression all these lazy people, you know? These very lazy people, he don't see, when he came there, he didn't see that it was social issues and social illness that dwell behind the walls of public housing. What they saw, I'm beginning to see also, is value of the land, okay? They didn't see people who had problems like young women that was like 23 years old with 5 or 6 babies. Okay. They didn't see that there was a welfare reform where a lot of people didn't walk into jobs like talking about. I always talk about the tax credit jobs because that's what a lot of the residents are receiving now, tax credit jobs. That means you're only good as long as the tax credit lasts. And then that's from 6 months to a year. That's what they're giving to the residents of public housing these days when they're so-called going welfare to work, the new law, okay? I also see every single day as a journalist, different people who don't seem to understand about the vacant lots. Why do people want to live by vacant lots? That's criminals in vacant lots. I have never, as long as I lived in Robertella, seen a drug dealer standing in a vacant lot saying, come get my drugs. I have never seen that, even today, which I didn't understand. The ruling then at that specific time until I started doing my research. When I started doing the research and finding out that the city owned every lot, almost, then I understood why they made this rule, okay? This rule is exactly to do what it's designed to do, push poor people out to the outskirts of the city of Chicago. But I also went to the outskirts. See, I'm one of those reporters who just don't stay home. I go all the way out. I went into Dalton, okay, along with my sister that's in the audience. And I talked to the mayor that was there. And I said, what do you think about the Section 8 vouchers coming here? He said, Beauty, this off the record. You know, nothing's off the record with a reporter. Remember that, okay? He said, off the record, I'm buying up all the property, and I'm not going to sell it. But I'm not going to endorse the hosts get it. Okay? Country Club Hill said the same thing.
So you got a lot of residents that's going out to these places that not going to even be able to go into the places because the mayor is buying up the property. Now, I want to remind you once again, there's never no thing, no such thing as off the record with a reporter. If you say something some kind of way, I'm going to get it back out you. Because that's the type of reporter that I am. Okay? Remember that. Okay? Off the record, right? Okay, I'm going to give it back to Steve.
I used to interact with reporters a lot. I mean, when you work at a mainstream institution like me, you were in our Rolodex. And one thing I remember, when you said, you know, you were one of those reporters a lot about that story, I remember over time, reporters got, and if any of the reporters out there, I'll take this wrong, just got lazier themselves. And Peterson was ripping out reports. And it was his rule of thumb, anything beyond a two-page executive summary, forget about it. I mean, you just had, it got to the point, you had to bullet point everything. And the only thing I want to do is still separate on equal side, there was a young lady at WBEZ that took it upon herself to actually read the whole story. I was after about 5 years, I was like, I was just amazed. I mean, you read the whole story, actually, you studied, you did it. It doesn't happen anymore. It used to happen more. It's getting less that way at times. So you got to change that training process in journalism school.
That's my thing.
So, coming to the what changes it, what's going to change all this question, there are basically two directions that we see when things change in society. One is the bottom-up kind of thing. Large numbers of angry people demand a change and win it. And I'd like to hear panelists' ideas on how that can be developed, how that kind of a movement, what kind of strategies you have in mind for developing that. And I'm going to take luxury of a second to describe what's not going to do it. What's not going to do it is the nice, benevolent, top-down kind of thing, where Oprah drops a few million on somebody, or some of those 3.26% minority owners of big media decide they have more allegiance to their people than their fellow business people and their stockholders. The way it's not going to be done is by Clear Channel not only tolerating a Cliff Kelly, but developing lots more of them. It's not going to be done by those who hold the power being nice to us and being nice to change things. It's going to be done by taking over newspapers, radio stations, television stations. We've blown it in Chicago for the next 8 years because their licenses are getting renewed for Chicago television stations for 8 years, and that's real media power in this city. And some of it's objective. I know Steve filed a complaint. But they're going to get them. They're going to get those licenses for 8 more years. So there's not going to be a nice FCC. There's not going to be nice rich people who are going to do this. Do you guys have some ideas on how the people who are not represented can have strategies and tactics to do something?
Okay, I can answer that. Okay, for one thing, it's going to start with you. And also forums like you see today, dialogue concerning the issues, okay? I have meetings myself. I have meetings every Friday at 6 o'clock at the Rain or Shine Baptist Church called the Poor People Millennium Movement. And the reason that I have these meetings is because the things that's happening in Chicago is affecting us all. I told people before they start tearing down the development, when they do this, when they tear down the houses in Robert Tellus, it's going to affect everybody. And I was asked how, okay? It was 7 churches across the street from Robert Tellus, 7 little black churches across the street. When they tear down those buildings and they build condominium townhouses and law, what makes you think they want to look across the street and see 7 little black churches in a 3-block ratio, okay? That's going to affect the churches as an area. It's going to affect the schools, for the simple fact that children are no longer there. Why should they continue to fund those schools with no children in them anymore? The business, it affects the business in the community because you have mom and papa, little grocery stores. Nobody I know that's living in condominium townhouses in law want to go to the little store around the corner with dust on the canned goods, okay? It affects them. It affected the elderly who had houses in the community. and had spent that $150,000 to get those houses in the beginning. And when they put a condominium at the end of the block that's worth millions of dollars, the taxes, the mortgages rises, okay? It affects everyone in the community. It was not just the poor people that's been affected by this plan, and still today, it's not just the poor that's been affected, but so-called middle income has been affected too. Like I told you, I got teachers calling me who have lost their jobs, bus drivers and police officers, okay? It's affecting each and every last one of us in this room today, or we wouldn't be dialoguing now. Dialoguing with each other and talking about the issues. Protesting like what I did today and what I'm gonna continue to do, regardless of if I got a pen in my hand or anything else. I'm gonna continue to do this because I know it's necessary. We need writers and fighters. We need Ida B. Wells and Harriet Tubmans and all those type of people today. Because we're living in those type of times. It's gonna take people like you who is concerned about the issues to continue to rise up with your voices, rise up with your papers, rise up with your pens, rise up with your friends, and do what's necessary to be done. Bring it to the tape, bring it to the surface. Bring it to the surface. That's what we're here to do today. Okay?
And I will be redundant as possible always, because sometimes we need to, things to just be pounded in our heads. It takes you. 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 Another thing or person that it takes is women. Women, if you, and I don't want anybody to get afraid of me saying this, but women affect change in such a powerful way. You can't deny how women affect change in every aspect of our society. And when you allow women, because not only is it the suburbanites and the rich who are controlling our media, it's men who are, rich men who are controlling our media. And when you allow women into those positions, you'll see that things start to change. There's just a climate that women produce when they're in a certain environment. And if we allow the women to take the leadership roles, we always talk about civil rights and the civil rights movement and everything. But there are a lot of women who were the brains behind the civil rights movement who we never hear about. And I'm not talking just about Rosa Parks not getting up off the bus, but I'm talking about women who actually were setting up those meetings and coordinating those meetings. Women who actually cooked and fed those hungry men when they came for meetings. Women who actually rallied the people in the community and rallied the members of the church. So what it takes is that allow the women in your lives to take leadership roles and to have outside interests. Because when women have outside interests, you'll never know who they'll come into contact with who also share stories. You think about the bus boycott, and that's just a general thought, but think about the bus boycott. A lot of those rich white women who lived off in the suburbs who the blacks were actually cleaning their floors, when they saw those women walking, they didn't allow them to walk home. They didn't allow the bus boycott to continue with these women just walking these miles and miles home and to and fro. They came along and they set up their own caravans to help those women to carry themselves back and forth. They actually set up different, I guess what we call jitney cab services. They set those up for the black women. So again, it's going to take you individually, and it's also going to take you supporting the interests of women, because again, women touch one another and they are more open to each other's stories and they'll share the stories. And then, like you said before, I'm sorry, like you said before, I mean, you have Stop Big Media. There are so many different media watch groups and media justice groups out who are, all you have to do is Google. Internet is the best thing going.
I think a lot of part of what I had said, what he said, what Steve said, a lot of that's a standard agenda that Lex's been talking about for a while. Work on those FCC licensing, there's an antitrust issue on a lot of these corporate media. There's a lot of policy agendas we know very well about. One thing I've mentioned a little off the beaten track, but might relate to what you're asking, is I found that particularly over years of night teaching and teaching working adults, one underestimated problem is time. The time people don't repeatedly tell me, I don't have time to read the newspapers anymore. I go, what are you talking about? You're doing all this, you're doing all that, you're talking about these vacations. We have the longest working hours in the industrialized world right now. We outpace the already exhausted Japanese back in the 1980s. There's a real good book about that called The Overworked American by Julian Shore. It's real interesting, and you hear a lot about that in a peripheral, that's the wrong word. You hear about it as a stress issue, as a family issue, as a relationship issue. People forget time is a democracy issue and was understood as such by the first people who talked about time as an issue, the early labor movement in the 19th century. Said, we don't have time to be part of this democracy. We need more time. We need to make different choices about our time. We need to consume differently and put ourselves in less sorts of time binds so that we have time to be the consumers and the makers of a kind of alternative media. And I just threw that in there because it doesn't get a lot of mention. But you're not going to have an alternative media without people having the time to access it. I encourage people to do. A lot of people take, people are just inured to and they just become routinized in the mindlessness of modern corporate media. Encourage people to do content analysis of media and talk about it and bring it up. Maybe even have community meetings, engage people. It's actually very interesting. And not just the news is saying, we talked a lot about the news, but in fact, entertainment media is just loaded with ideology. Steve, in his book, mentions a movie that's relevant to Chicago called Judgment Day. It's got Emilio Estevez and Cuba Gooding Jr. in it, and it's perfect. It's just this white suburban moral panic, this fear. I just said, talk to people, take a look at media critically in like a media end. It's not that tough. Do a critical media analysis, everything, and talk about with people, and don't just focus only on the news. The other thing is very powerful. I've seen people do this. I've been involved in some cases. I've done a lot of tours. You know, the media makes the inner city simultaneously sort of incredibly invisible, but also terrifying at the same time. I worked at 45th in Michigan for 5 years and never had one issue. I used to take the L over there. I used to ride my bike over there from Hyde Park, all this kind of. Organize exchanges. A lot of times, inner city, particularly school levels, is very powerful. A lot of times, black kids in places like Grand Boulevard, North London, they knew they were in the back of mind somewhere they're getting ripped off, but they never have quite a full idea how ripped off they were getting until they go to Hinsdale and see what 18,000 or 20,000 a year per school, per student pays for the gymnasiums, the athletic facilities. But quite frankly, a lot of the suburban white kids and parents and so forth also. They'll tell me, I used to do some of these, I had no idea. And sometimes I thought I was kind of disingenuous, but from given what I knew about segregation, how separate people live, that's the truth. And when people get on the other side of the dashboard, the other side of the zoning classification, the other side of the school district, the other side of the property classification, so on and so forth, go to where it's currency exchanges instead of banks, or it's just these mom-and-pop grocery stores / liquor stores instead of full-service grocery stores, get some people over there for sustain them. And then they go back and they look at corporate media and its images a little bit differently too. And see, you didn't get threatened so much as what you witnessed was human pain and human deprivation. And the segregation matters not just because it's segregation per se, because housing markets distribute so much more than housing. Access to everything that the American dream. So when you organize that, people come back and look at me a little critically and go, whoa, that's not right.
I'll just quickly second what Beauty said. Protest. One word. I mean, that, Bob, in a nutshell, is how we're going to affect change. And it's going to start small. I mean, there's not very many people here today. I realize that. But if we hold a protest, we speak out, and the numbers will grow. Because I do think it's an issue that people care about. People feel, according to opinion surveys, people feel like the corporate media are deceiving them. Journalists are today less trustworthy, according to some opinion polls conducted by the Pew Center for the People and the Press, than used car salesmen. That's because people don't trust what they're getting. And I think if we start to protest and demand change, change will come.
Been terrified of our elected office. What are they doing, they and Tia Harry, to do about the poor? Marcy don't get you nowhere now. That's reality, Katie, because only a small group come out. They're still going to put up $180,000 condominium, $200,000 townhouses, going to eliminate jobs in the city. What are our elected office doing? They just gave themselves a nice pay increase not long ago. During the time when the big boxer game is coming on, he backed it for just $10. And they gave themselves a $4,000 raise. What are our elected office doing?
Okay, first of all, that's where you come in, okay? I already know what's on your mind, Sabrina, to do the surveys and stuff concerning that issue, okay? But it's still gonna take people like ourselves to keep raising this issue in their faces. I always say, if the weary don't rest, neither should the wicked, okay? Otherwise, we're supposed to stay in their faces, making them do what's necessary to be done. I have won many battles protesting, okay? You can win battles by protesting, but that's all it is battles. We gotta struggle out here, okay? It's a struggle. It's a crisis. It is an economic crisis, you're right.
It ain't about to come about this no more. It's about the economic
right.
crisis.
That's right, like I told you earlier, this is Emerald City. They want to see the green and not the brown unless it's fertilizing the green. I was truthful about that, okay? But that's why it's going to take each and every last one of you up to come out here and continue to do what's necessary. Just don't sit back and let this continue without a fight. Don't give up before you even get started, okay?
I just wonder how many Chicago residents even know who their alderman is, who their congresspeople are, and who their senators are. And how many of us know how our alderman voted for, let's say, the big box ordinance? Do we know what our alderman voted for that? Do we know other different things that have been on the floor for the Fred Hampton Way drive? Do we know what our aldermen are thinking about? Are they voting our interests? Or are they voting on the fifth floor? When they get up there on the fifth floor, are they voting what they're going in the back room and the six of them are getting together and say, hey, vote this way, so I'll have your back next time. It's up to you to know what your aldermen are doing and for you to hold them accountable and for you to say, hey, listen, I saw that. I got the Freedom of Information Act and I went in there and I saw how you voted. We don't agree with that. That is not a part of what we want and you do not represent us. So next election time, you get it together, vote our way or you're out of here. And only you can put them out of office.
That's absolutely right. You said a crisis going on. I just looked at the latest census data because now they got this thing called American Community Survey that comes in between the 10-year censuses. The black poverty rate has gone up to between 2000 and 2004 from 29% in Chicago to 33%. It is back to the Reagan era nadir, the all-time low. How that big box thing happened in the first place? I realize they came out 2 votes short, and he ended up, he could turn them. But they're coming back with something more. That was remarkable. I still take a silver lining and a hope out of that. And when you roll a ball up a hill, and you just think, oh my God, we did that, don't go away. You've got to watch that policy after it happens. And I'll tell you right, I'm doing a study right now on Protestants for the Common Good, we did the study at the League on incarceration and Obama pretended to be all excited about it as the state senate just passed this bill to undo some occupational licensure barriers for ex offenders, for people with felony records in Chicago. How they passed this thing, and it was narrow, so he could have a win and move on. He's got on his resume now on his campaign trail, and running for the president, he talks about it a lot. It covers the tiniest little portion of the ex offender population. People with just one nonviolent offense, they moved it up to two, and they got rid of some occupational license barriers for 15. Occupational licenses. And these guys are coming out of jail with most of them with high school dropouts, aren't even qualifying for these. So we're breaking that down and we're going to publicize that. We're not going to let them get away or other state legislators get away with saying that they did this like radical revolutionary thing that made everything okay. Now all the people say you can't ever rehabilitate prisoners at all and it's hopeless, blah, blah, blah. this proves it. They did this. They, you know, we're going to be there. We're going to study this thing very carefully. Say, you can't say that. This thing was way too narrow, and this wasn't anywhere close. You've got to watch those policies after they happen to, and not go home after you get a little busy.
Yes, I just had a couple of points that I think might be helpful for people here. It is actually possible to pressure the FCC. It takes a lot of agitation, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, and a lot of people. For example, in 2003, I can't remember if it's 2 or 3 million letters that were written regarding the ownership issue, and sure enough, that put enough pressure on to stop a horrible set of, well, regulations, they called it deregulations, but a horrible set of things were about to pass through the FCC. And because it was brought to the attention belatedly, even through some of the mainstream press, eventually the regular people out there started finding out what was going on. And that is now under consideration again. That was not a settled issue, it's just a delayed issue, okay? So what we need everyone in this room to do is to make their comments known to the FCC, and we will help you do that through our organization and through our website, so that you can make comments, and especially, and I have to stress this, even within the activist community, I don't know exactly how well it's understood how important minority ownership issues are. They really didn't come up the last time around. We really did barely address them. And there, it was like the shark underneath the water. And so I'd like to see that fish this time around a lot more strongly. And we will support you, anybody who wants to comment to the FCC. We will try to help you. It's not that hard to do. Don't be afraid. You can join several million people. Just out of curiosity factor, we turned up last night that Bill O'Reilly is coming to Chicago. O'Reilly on the road. We'll work something out, maybe a birthday cake, if that's October 9th. He'll be here at the old First National Bank building. I'd like a little bit of comment on this new WBEZ feature that's coming with the new station. Any thoughts on that? Because that's supposed to be a big urban experiment. So let's see how much of an experiment it turns out to be. So we're going to have to pressure there. And of course, we have to pressure WVON because I'm not sure what their ownership situation really is.
I'll just make a quick comment because I know it's getting late, but let's speak directly to WBEZ, the WBEZ situation. WBEZ is planning to roll out some big new programming strategy, which is a great big mystery. And nobody really knows what they're planning to do. It's an effort, as I understand it, to make the station younger, to make the demographics of the station younger and more urban, so to appeal more to people who actually live in the city of Chicago. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be. Rumors are they're going to have edgier programming. Something and we will sort of have to wait and see what exactly they're planning on doing. The other thing that WBEZ is doing is, of course, establishing some storefront studios around the city in an effort to localize their news. They have already purchased a storefront studio and are setting one up in Humboldt Park, and they are going to set one up in Inglewood. We will again have to sort of wait and see, but this may create an opportunity for community organizations and activist groups to bend the ear of some WBEZ reporters, and perhaps, as the guy from the Tribune who's now left was suggesting, establish some relationships with reporters. But as I said before, my real hope is in protest, because I think that it's only when ordinary people are being disruptive and speaking out about how lousy the news media are that we're actually going to get change. Speaking out to the FCC, filing comments about this new round of ownership, new ownership regulations. We have to do that, and we have to intervene. And frankly, we've got to inform more people so we can have more people involved in the process. Anybody else want to make one last comment here?
Okay.
Okay. My last comment to each and every last one of you is to let you understand that all the power is in you. The power's in the people. I always tell people, this is an election year. One of the most crucial election years that you're ever going to come into. So the power is really in you. Whether you out there and elect people, or whether you revolutionary or whatever, the power is still in you to bring forth truth. And that's what I try to bring through my writing and through my fighting. And I'm hoping that each and every last one of you join me in that. Each one of you have a talent, a gift. Use it to continue to help others. That's my story, and that's my end, and that's to you with love.
Beauty is you are really, I just want to let you know, you're really touching my heart with a lot of the things that you're saying. But my last statement is this. As a member of the National Hip Hop Political Convention and a lover of hip hop and being born and bred into the music, it'll be remiss of me not to even mention that when we talk about the changes that are coming. I think that music has always been the force of change in our society. If you want to just look as near as the Vietnam War and the protest songs that were going on then, and the police brutality that Marvin Gaye spoke about, and the injustices of the world that Stevie Wonder talked about. But because hip hop is near and dear to me, and I relate to that, and that's what I listen to. And I believe that if we looked and did our statistics, I don't have facts in front of me to rattle anything off, but I can assure you that it is the number one music in the country right now, beating out country music. And I suggest that you pay attention to that, and you pay attention to who's speaking and what they're speaking about. Because a lot of what is being said is forcing a change and bringing it to the forefront. It's bringing the inner city into the suburbs, into where parents who thought their children were sequestered away from the rest of the world is bringing that rest of the world right there into their own homes, and nobody can deny it. So I'm telling you that music, and especially for me, hip hop, will also be a force of change that will force the rest of us to wake up and listen to someone else's story.
I would just say finally, I think alongside the military industrial complex and prison industrial complex, the dominant corporate media is the single leading evil institutional nexus that we need to deal with the United States of America in the next 20, 25 years if we're going to have any chance of rescuing the democratic American political tradition and democracy as a progeny in this country. Popular media, control of our information, is a fundamental part of power to the people.
Thank you all for coming, and if you haven't yet already, you can sign up for information about more CMA events, get on the CMA mailing list, there's a sign-up sheet on the table at the back as you go out. So thanks again for coming, everyone. Oh yeah, please, Lakeisha has something to hand out. Sorry. Put that in the suggestion box. Thanks so much.